This episode, I'm joined once again by writer and occultist John Michael Greer to discuss the cyclic nature of history and consciousness. I'd like to say a big thank you to my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you'd like to support the podcast, if you've enjoyed anything that's been published this year, then please find links in the description below for the Patreon. Otherwise, I hope you all have a very merry Christmas day, and please enjoy. So, John Michael Greer, thanks once again for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me on.
And as is the tradition on this podcast now, it's become a tradition, this will go out live Christmas Day. So Merry Christmas to everyone listening.
And you know, happy 4 days past solstice to everyone else.
That's the one I was going to ask. I mean, what? So is that the Druid?
Yeah.
Solstice?
Well, insofar as Druids do anything in common, It's the usual thing, ask three Druids, get at least five answers. The solstices and the equinoxes are important to us. And so the one of the advantages of being a Druid is you get to open your presents 4 days early.
It differs in country as well, I think, in terms of what day many people actually... So a lot of people celebrate on what I would know as Christmas Eve, and I enjoy the season anyway. I don't enjoy the specific days. I enjoy the season.
Exactly. It's a lovely season.
But there we go. Anyway, we're going to discuss collapse and civilizational descent.
Yes. And here under the Christmas tree, you have the decline and fall of Western civilization.
Exactly.
I expect oohs and ahs, yes.
So it's been a long time. I mean, we used to, years ago now, time flies. Mm-hmm. Time flies when you're just discussing collapse. Well, time flies when the world is collapsing. We used to discuss this, and then you moved from the Arcturid Report through to Echo Sophia, and mm-hmm. With the emphasis there being, you know, this in between of ecology and esotericism, I guess,
mm-hmm.
And not so much emphatically like the Arcturid Report, which was more on the decline of the West. So there's mm-hmm. always been this mixture, but so many people have asked, you know, can we do an update? And it seemed like time, because the world has become almost like a caricature now of, if you don't see it, where are you looking? But I actually want to, it's probably a really, really broad discussion as per usual, mm-hmm. but I actually want to begin mm-hmm. with your studies probably many, many years ago. So you, I believe as your undergrad, you studied, was it comparative religion?
No, I had a complex college career, and the degree I ended up with was Comparative History of Ideas.
Comparative History of Ideas. Okay. That's where I got the comparative thing from.
Yes. Now, you got part of it right, certainly. Go ahead.
Now, the reason I want to start with that is I know that you are a fan of the works of Spengler and Toynbee,
mm-hmm.
The two most notable historians mm-hmm. who have written these cyclical theories of history.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I just want to begin with the question of, can you remember first coming across either of their work and sort of what, as we're speaking about the decline of you know, and collapse, I mean, I think these mm-hmm. two thinkers are key to look at. You know, I guess the question is, you know, was it like, okay, finally someone hasn't written a sort of, biased mm-hmm. reading of history? And also, why do you think they're avoided? Because it still seems so many people are just even reluctant mm-hmm. to touch mm-hmm. their work. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Toynbee goes back a long ways. There was a copy of the one-volume edition of the Condensation of Toynbee's Study of History in the family room when I was a child. We had big bookshelves. My dad read a lot. And so there was I don't know why he got it or when he read it or what he thought of it, really. I don't think we ever talked about that. But there was a copy, and so I made note of it. I didn't read it at the time. I happened to stumble across it years later in... this would be in the Seattle Public Library when I lived in Seattle. They had a copy. I said, hey, it's in history. Check it out. And my immediate response was, okay, that's interesting, but I'm not sure that it follows. I thought that there was very clearly, now, of course, this is the one volume thing. It was a lot of stuff very condensed down. I was saying, okay, you're making a very specific case here. I'm not sure that there's a lot that's being left out here. And I wasn't quite ready to go plunge into the 12 hefty volumes that actually make up Toynbee's work. That happened later. The later in question was when I encountered Spengler. And that was literally, I was on my way to a peak oil event. Okay, so this was early on in my period of peak oil activism. I just started being invited to events around the country. And so I was traveling to this, and I wanted a book so that I had something to, something to read while going through the miseries of travel. And I had Spengler's first volume, the first of his two volumes of The Decline of the West. And I was sitting there in the waiting room in the train station waiting for the train to arrive and reading this thing and going, oh boy, this explains so much. Mm. And the thing about Spengler, the reason that it explains so much is that he made it very, very clear he was not talking about causes. He was setting the entire issue of what causes decline and fall aside and saying, how does it happen? Is there a comparative morphology here? Is there a set of patterns that we can see recurring over time? And then he showed that, yes, there is. And so that movement to morphology, that shift toward, you know, we can bicker about the causes later, what actually happens, struck me as extremely fruitful. And then watching his delineation, in 1918, he's setting out, this is what we can expect Western civilization to go through from here on in. And I'm just going, okay, check that box, check that box, check that box, to down page after page, 100 years, you know, nearly a century on. Now, of course, it's been more than a century. And he was just hitting one, to use an Americanism, he was hitting one out of the ballpark after another. And so that was the point where I went, okay, I need to go back and read Arnold Toynbee. And the library system where I then lived had, you know, they had copies of the whole set. And so I slogged through it and finally saved up the money to buy a copy. And so that I could really brood over it. And came to the conclusion that Spengler had the morphology, I think, down better than most. Better than any of the others. Toynbee talks about causation, and he talks about it in a way that actually works, and he makes some very, very good points. Both of them need to be understood, I think, in each other's context. There are some other theories of cyclical history that also deserve inclusion in that. But why doesn't anybody talk about Spengler and Toynbee these days? It's because they're right. You know, the worst thing you can do is be right in any society, is to be right in an unpopular way. We have this myth of progress. We have this belief that, you know, the future is ours. We are destined to go onward and upward in this grand march from the caves to the stars. And, you know, and everything has to get better because we believe in progress. Progress is the god of Western civilization. And Spengler and Toynbee and Giambattista Vico and some of the other people that I've read that have really influenced my view here are saying, no, we're not going to the stars. Mm-hmm. We've peaked. We actually peaked some time ago. And at this point, we're elaborating certain technologies, sure, but look at what standards of living are doing. Look at what's going on in the world as everything step by step falls apart in the same way as all those civilizations in the past. That's what they're saying. They're saying it very clearly. They're explaining it in detail. They've got all the footnotes. Well, Toynbee has whole volumes that are basically gargantuan footnotes. But they've got all the details. So it's all right there. And nobody wants to hear that because that means we don't get our Tomorrowland future. We don't get to trample the stars in our 7 parsec boots. You know?
Mm-hmm. So, just, I guess, briefly, and I guess it differs from thinker to thinker, what does a civilizational cycle look like? I believe Spengler had seasons, right?
Yes. Spengler liked to use the seasonal cycle, just as a metaphor, okay? Mm-hmm. So you have the springtime, which, you know, is not a... This is a German springtime, okay? It's gray, it's wet, it's rainy, it's cold, and you slog through mud a lot. It's a period, it is an age of faith. It is an era of generally rural society. The core of society is, you know, basically scattered farms and little villages all over the place with a few cities scattered here and there. The basic social form is feudalism. The basic religious form is a predominant, overwhelmingly believed in religious faith that gives everyone their basic context. That's springtime. Summertime comes, we get the birth of rationalism, we get the rise of cities, feudalism gives way to typically to some kind of monarchical system, and you have the birth of new art forms, you have scholarship taking the lead, you have various new ventures in the sciences and technologies. That's the summer. Okay, autumn, the monarchy fades out into bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. And you end up with, at this point, the rationalism petrifies. It becomes dogmatic. It fossilizes into bureaucratic forms. The economy begins to falter. It's the harvest time, culturally speaking. You have enormous developments in literature, in the arts, in knowledge about the world. Great classics are written, but everything's falling away bit by bit underneath, and in particular, the rural economy that's the foundation of the whole thing is steadily failing. Mm-hmm. There's often some topsoil loss and other problems like that involved, but one way or another, the whole thing's winding down. Then you get into winter, as things simply come apart, and there's no longer enough of an economy to hold the society together. It breaks apart. You plunge into a dark age. Out of that dark age, a new springtime emerges. So that's the cycle. It's very straightforward. If you pick up a book of history from any past civilization, you will see it sketched out in fine detail. And it's purely our fond delusion of being destiny's darlings. The only people who really understand the universe that were stuck in this false belief that it doesn't apply to us. Go ahead.
Where are we in the cycle?
We're on the autumn on the edge of winter.
Autumn on the edge. That's not too bad.
Basically, we've been through the bureaucratization. We've seen the replacement of monarchies with vast, sprawling bureaucracies. Our rural areas are increasingly impoverished and increasingly abandoned by anybody who's interested. Our cities have become hugely overblown. We've had, the 100 years of extraordinary artistic and literary and creative features. And now we're heading into a dark age. Mm. Now we've reached the point in the Western societies, Europe and the European diaspora, that the foundations for civilized life are breaking apart, and down we go. Whee!
So, many, many times you've written books commenting on what a dark age, mm-hmm. collapsed society will look like, and given many practical tips as well in Collapse Now and Avoid mm-hmm. the Rush, most famously. But I want to bring in, the other side of your work, the spiritual side to your work, mm-hmm. With a quote from one of your most recent pieces of writing, Science as Enchantment, where you say, just as politics is downstream from culture, culture is downstream from imagination, and imagination mm-hmm. is downstream from the states of consciousness that give imagination its context. Mm-hmm. Those states mm-hmm. of consciousness change over time, and the change isn't necessarily one way. So instead mm-hmm. of saying what will collapse look like, because I think empirically, look out of your windows, if you have eyes to see. But what does the modern Western consciousness look like right now?
A mess. it resembles nothing so much as the streetscape. I'm gonna step back here and talk about the cycle of consciousness, mm-hmm. because that's also very important. This is something that Giambattista Vico, who doesn't get a lot of discussion these days, mm-hmm. talked about in great detail. A civilization or a culture, a society starts out in a state of collapse that is as much internal as external. The certainties of the previous age have been refuted by events, and it's all the way down to what Vico called the barbarism of sense. All you can be sure of is what you actually perceive yourself. Mm-hmm. All of the reason, all of the philosophy and the law and the intricate constructions of consciousness that you get in a late civilization, all that has been swept away. And so from that, putting things together, developing the metaphors, because we always think in metaphors, of course, mm-hmm. but developing the metaphors that make sense of the world, religion becomes the touchstone. And so you have, in the springtime and going on into the summer, you have this tendency to focus on religious metaphors. That's why it's an age of faith. Everything's personalized. Everything is anthropomorphized. The rain and the wind have names, and you can talk to them. And so gradually, the barbarism of sense gives way to the development of abstractions, a more abstract, less personal, less anthropomorphic way of thinking about things evolves. And it's different in every civilization, but you know, ours took place originally by way of scholastic philosophy, and then that morphed into science. The religion gradually gets ditched. What that means is that the religious ideology gets taken, and all the serial numbers are filed off it, and some abstraction or other gets put in place of its deities. And so you end up with this secular structure that becomes more and more abstract, more and more complicated, more and more intricate, more and more detached from reality. That's where we are now. We have a situation where most people are thinking in terms of vague, general abstractions that they think of are more real than the things they actually encounter. You see this in the political sphere all the time. People are, you know, any of the wars that are going on right now, for example, it's all side A, they're the good people, and here are the abstract reasons why they're the good people. Side B, they're the bad people, and here are the abstract reasons why they're the bad people. It has nothing to do with what's actually going on the battlefield. Or what's going on in the two sides. It's purely a matter of we're assigning a set of abstractions to these, and reality is supposed to follow suit. Ukraine is a great example. Right now we have, you know, the Russians were loaded with the abstractions in the Western press of being the bad guys. That means they have to be incompetent, they have to be inadequately supplied, and because they're the bad guys and their job is to lose, right? Except somebody forgot to tell Vladimir Putin that. Of course, from the Russians' point of view, they're the good guys. And the Ukrainians are the Nazis. They're replaying the Second World War. But, you know, that doesn't get into the Times. That doesn't even get into the Daily Fail. So what you have here is a situation where people are so caught up in their... In these abstract ideas, these abstract notions about how the world ought to be, do they lose track of what's actually going on? Of course, the whole business of progress is the supreme example in our time. People are convinced we're going to the stars. Here are these marvelous inventions that surely will revolutionize our lives, and we're not going to talk about the last three dozen that failed to do so. We'll have flying cars any day now. Don't notice the fact the first flying car took off in 1917. It was a dud, and so has every other flying car been. And so, you know, but it's still stuck on those abstractions. So we're in the situation where by and large, in the Western world, people's heads are full of these totally irrelevant abstract views on the world that get in the way of their dealing with what's actually happening in society. That, in turn, is one of the major factors that drives the coming of the Dark Age, because the abstractions collapse. It becomes just too much of a burden to keep on believing in progress when everything's falling apart around you.
Has anything ever persevered throughout the
Oh, lots of things. I mean, human nature is what it is. There's a lot of stuff that survives. I mean, we have, for example, literary works dating back many, many cycles. You can pick up a copy of the Epic of Gilgamesh if you want. That's been around for a while. So there are literary creative works that last. There are intellectual achievements that last. We still have logic. The Greeks invented that. And there are various other things that become part of the sort of continuing knowledge base. But one of the things that happens during the Dark Age, during the last part of autumn, actually, and into winter, is a sorting through of what has been produced by the previous civilization. And people are basically picking over the ruins and saying, wow, okay, this is worth saving. That, not so much. Which is how logic got to us, for example. A lot of people in various parts of the world picked up Greek logic, said, wow, I could use this, and walked off with it.
Do you think anything of our era, let's say going back 100 years, just for the sake of it, do you think anything distinctly from the last 100 years, one, if you were to travel forward 1,000 years, you might see?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I expect some literary works to survive. It would amaze me, for example, if Tolkien's Lord of the Rings doesn't, mm-hmm. you know, become one of those enduring classics. Mm-hmm. So there will be some literary works. Those are easy to pass on, easy to transmit into the future. It would not surprise me at all. I mean, most of our artworks will be gone, but some things will survive from that. In terms of ideas, the great age of Western philosophy ended by about 1850. So it's unlikely that any of our philosophical thought is going to make it. It will, if copies survive, they will be treated the way that like late Roman philosophy is treated, as kind of products of decadence, something that what was going on after all the really interesting thinkers died. Will some of our technologies, possibly, only the simple ones, though. One thing that I expect to survive, however, is organic agriculture. Mm-hmm. One of the great achievements of the 20th century was the development in the Western world, of systems of agriculture that are sustainable over the long term. Those are likely to survive simply because people who take them up are likely to get by much better than people who don't once we no longer have fertilizers and fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. So there will be heritage. There will be a range of things passed on. Some of them will be incredibly stupid. I mean, there are things from Roman times, bits of artwork. I'm thinking of the very famous sculpture. I don't recall at the moment where it was found, somewhere in Italy, which is Pan having an intimate relationship with a nanny goat. It's a beautiful bronze sculpture. You know, he's gazing lovingly into her eyes. She's gazing lovingly into his while they do the thing. And, you know, there it is.
So there's often this... that's often used as a fictional device. I mean, it's used well in Canticle for Leibowitz, right? This, mm-hmm. this notion of digging up stuff from the past and then, you could say, extrapolating an incorrect reading of mm-hmm. what those people were like. I mean, if for instance people were to dig up a few of our common knickknacks and things we use, I mean, what do you think future generations would think of us moderns?
We would have to know what their society valued and what their society thought of the past. I mean, you know, most our archaeologists are constantly going, I don't know what that is. It must be religious. Okay, that's what our archaeologists do, and it lands them an enormous amount of stupidity. I happen to know some people who, for example, are spinners. They use drop spindles, and they will tear their hair out over the number of archaeologists who say, well, here's this pierced disc that has some curious wear patterns. It must be a religious artifact. It's a spindle whirl. But you know, you can't tell that to the archaeologists because they're the experts. Doubtless some similar thing will go on.
Okay.
You know, 1,000 years from now, people will be digging up the ruins of the ancient Americans. You know, okay, here we've actually, you know, we sent an expedition through the Western deserts to the long abandoned ruins of Las Vegas. Okay, and this must have been a center of religious pilgrimage. People came here to make offerings.
Well, that's not entirely wrong. That's not entirely wrong, though, is it?
It's not entirely wrong. But they must have worshipped a fertility goddess.
Yeah, all these poles everywhere.
These poles, they're phallic symbols, you understand. And priestesses did sacred dances, you know, something like that.
I mean, just to stay on that, I guess, in a way, this notion of the idea that, you know, the sense of secular worship. I mean, this is, I know you're very fond of Joseph and Storm's The Myth of Disenchantment. And,
mm-hmm.
I have maybe not so much a disagreement as just a place of discussion, I guess, is, you know,
mm-hmm.
the idea of the myth of progress, or maybe you can say in relation to Las Vegas, both progress and the myth of, like, you know, being a billionaire or whatever, or getting rich quick.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see the belief in progress as quite literally the same as, say, the belief in pick a god or a goddess from antiquity? I mean, are these two forms of quote unquote worship or belief the same?
They're not quite the same. This is actually something I discussed at some length in my book After Progress. There is a difference between a secular religion and a theological religion. Okay. Mm-hmm. We have a couple of good examples of secular religion. The faith in progress is one. Marxism is another.
Mm-hmm.
They basically take over the metaphors of the earlier theological religion. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then, but apply those metaphors to a salvation and a historic narrative that exists entirely in the world of everyday life. So that instead of the second coming of Jesus, you have the revolution of the proletariat. Okay. Or what have you. But it's not quite the same. A secular faith has a different, you know, it has different emphases. It has different expressions. It rarely actually has formal temples. At most, you might have a few shrines, like, you know, like Lenin's tomb. But it doesn't actually have the temples, the formal priesthood, this kind of stuff. It goes on in a slightly less informal way. It simply fills the same ideological need in people's minds to have a narrative that makes sense of their world and that glorifies them in some way.
It seems to fill that void in the mind. I mean, mm-hmm. going back to Las Vegas, that, you know, I know plenty of people who would say. Older friends who would say, oh, at some point I'd love to go there, which sounds, you know, almost like someone, a Catholic, saying, oh, at some point I'd love to go to Lourdes. You know, it's this
thing, yeah.
this far-off pilgrimage that needs to be. But there's a difference that
yes.
it fills, but it doesn't fulfill. So why is that? Because it's not real? Because, well, like you've been saying, it's actually not. It's all abstraction once again.
Partially it's all abstraction. I will be unpopular here and suggest that human beings really do have something that we could call a religious instinct, an orientation toward the unseen, toward the spirit, toward what we call the spiritual realm, and that's not just an artifact of society. That's something that's as essential to us as sex or as hunger. And so, the secular faiths, such as the faith in progress, such as Marxism, and so on, they're kind of ersatz equivalents. There's a pretense of fulfilling that religious need, but they don't connect to anything transcendent. They don't reach into the unseen. They don't actually, you know, answer the simple but essential question, okay, when I die, what next? Or any of the other things that religions do. And so I think one of the reasons they don't get the temples, and all the other paraphernalia of actual theological religions, is they don't really meet the need. Mm-hmm. By the way, I've been to Las Vegas twice. Yeah. I thought it was a pretty fierce simulacrum of hell. It was a horrible place.
Well, it was just.
The thing is, actually, it's the one place that really made me understand the Christian concept of sin, which normally has just left me going, what? Both times I was attending a conference on alchemy. Now, talk about ironies, okay? But so I was at this alchemy conference, and we were in this second-rate casino hotel, and the conference had the meeting rooms, and we had a big block of rooms for everybody, but there was also the casino going on downstairs. To get from the hotel rooms to the meeting rooms, you had to go through the casino, and to get food in the place, you had to go into the casino, because that's where all the restaurants were. And it was this nightmarish kind of thing where there were all these people caught up in a trance of frustrated craving, bending over the slot machines, or bending over the tables, and just radiating this aura of greed and fake hope and craving and misery and despair. It was hideous.
We could stay on that. I mean, why... why do you think so many people end up there?
Because it's the closest thing our society offers to a religious pilgrimage.
Yeah.
Because it feeds into the dream that maybe you can be a millionaire. Maybe you can be one of those that, you know, stride forth to the cutting edge of the grand march of humanity, blah, blah, blah. People are easy to bamboozle. That's one of the things you can count on in our species. People will believe what they want to believe. They'll believe what they're taught, even when it's nonsense. People bought into Marxism for how long? People buy into the belief in progress right now, even though we've been clearly regressing for about 50 years. People are easy to bamboozle. So they keep on going back because, you know, gambling is addictive for a lot of people.
Yeah. So, I mean, to draw this into the notion of cycles of consciousness as well, and your quote from Science's mm-hmm. Enchantment, I've been reading a book recently called Catafalque by Peter Kingsley, which is...
I'm familiar with King. I'm familiar with Kingsley. I haven't read Catafalque yet.
It's great, but one short excerpt that I was reading last night that stood out to me in relation to this Las Vegas alchemical anecdote of your own is that he differentiates individualism and individuation, so Jungian individuation. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, take any esoteric current as well, and you'll find some mm-hmm. form mm-hmm. of true mm-hmm. will or whatever you want to call it, but mm-hmm. individuation. But it's interesting that he says that... for Jung, it was a luciferic energy for individualism, you know, for this, mm-hmm. I choose this box of cereal to be my breakfast cereal. I choose this brand jumper for mine. I choose this casino, right? This is all these so-called empirical choices which bolster the false ego and mm-hmm. the individual. And, you know, this cycle of consciousness, homogenize, like more so homogenize that form of individualism and really block off, really occlude possibilities and avenues of individuation? Because, I mean, one of the errors I can't really get out of my own mind is that the modern world, the modern world is no different in terms of cycles, but it does seem to be different in its negatives, in that in terms of history, it seems mm-hmm. to be one of the worst times to live for things that get in your way of that possibility, or have we always really not cared all this much?
No, this is actually part of the cycle. Hmm. One of the things I wrote about earlier this year. I'm going to lose the name of the book now. The Satyricon by Petronius Arbiter. Hmm. Okay, it's a late Roman novel. Mm-hmm. We have only a portion of it. It's a work, we would now call it a work of pornography. There's a lot of sex in it. And it is just as alienated from individuation, from spirituality, as, you know, any modern, you know, cheap, you know, Hollywood sex and what have you, thriller. Mm-hmm. On the, you know, in for sale in supermarkets today, it's the same stuff. We are in a period. We happen to be living in a period right now where the piling up of abstractions, the heaping up of arbitrary beliefs, the detachment from the realities of the human condition is at its maximum. And so, yes, right now, and, you know, for a century, more than a century before, and for some time to come, there's going to be that barrier in place. But there was that barrier in place in Roman times, too. There was that barrier in place in other times. It's normal. Now, you know, that doesn't mean it's easy. That doesn't mean we should just go, oh, well, no big deal. You know, it's something we have to struggle with. You know, those who were born in this period.
I think the technologies we've developed have made it, have accelerated those barriers, have made them, in a sense of actual quality, worse.
No, I don't actually think so. I think that people in the Roman Colosseum watching gladiators slaughter themselves right in front of them were just as they were just as caught up in the spectacle, just as detached from the spirit as anybody else, or going to the pantomime where you have, you know, lots of naked flesh and things like that. It was that we do this with technology, but what we're doing is actually not that different. It's like military affairs. If you look back in the history of Babylonia, where they were dealing with the Kassites in the north, they had exactly the same problem that modern empires have had dealing with the fractious people, and they were dealing with a counterinsurgency situation. The weapons were different. The means of transport were different. The strategic problems were the same. Mm. In the same way, the specific technologies of distraction that we're using are different. Mm. But the level of distraction, again, read the Satyricon. There's this great moment where one of the guests at this appalling banquet, Trimalchio is very nouveau riche and very crass, and he's throwing this big banquet at which our protagonist is attending. And one of the old guys there is going on about how nobody believes in the gods anymore and doing just this exactly canned. You've heard this same speech a dozen times you know, from old people here and now. And it's the same consciousness, the same sense of distance from the spiritual, immersion in the abstract, immersion in a cloud of mental chatter.
So, no, you know, nothing new under the sun, but I would also, you know, a lot of people, they do this classic thing just in relation to this fact that nothing's really changing. or, you know. Different technology, same, you know, abstract thing being undertaken, let's say. A lot of people do this thing where they, you know, it's an element of the myth of progress, most definitely, where they anything back in time, and you say, well, we could do that. And they'll say, oh, do you want to, the classic one is, oh, you want to live back then? Do you want to get typhoid? Right. And they conflate, history with the, like,
oh, yeah.
The empirical illness which would have happened at the time. But what's interesting, more interesting about that is actually if you look at the data that we have, at least, of the longevity of people, is that, sure, statistically you can read it and say, oh, so X amount of people died before they were 30. But then, okay, that is completely true. I'm not going to deny that. But then when you look at another piece of data, which is that if people do survive after 30, their median life expectancy is still around 75, 80. Right. So there's this notion of like, oh, you know, if you're in Victorian Britain, it would have been the worst thing ever. You'd have been, you know, typhoid from birth and you'd have, you know, everyone, like this notion that everyone was sick and dying. Well, how did we get here if that was the truth? Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
All I was going to say is, you know, one of the very difficult pills to swallow, I think, of the modern world, where we put such an emphasis, you know, one of the immediate defenses of the modern world is, well, what about modern medicine? What about modern surgery? Which to me, the majority of modern medicine is the equivalent of a hammer and sickle to your, you know, first you have to take what's the saying? You take the antibiotics and then you have to take something else to recover from the antibiotics, right? Point being is that it doesn't really seem that we've gone, you know, and I'll put my own skin in the game here because a lot of people say that's completely unequivocally just not true. But we really haven't moved that much further than the stereotype of the witch doctor to the modern doctor. Not that much has changed at all. You know, people aren't suddenly surviving into their 120s. People still have chronic illnesses, which modern doctors cannot figure out. And the way they figure them out is just to define them with a label. And that to them is like the equivalent of cure. And everyone else is just medicated into a sort of a strange haze. I'll risk saying it so other people don't have to. But we just haven't moved that far at all. And I think it's hubris that...
I'm going to quibble very slightly, not with your conclusion, but with a couple of the details, okay? We have actually accomplished something very important, which is actually has been a major problem, which is that... infant mortality has dropped very sharply since, and it was not, by the way, physicians who did this. It was the invention of modern sanitation. Once people figured out that basically you have to make sure that water is clean. It was that simple. That caused the steep drop in infant mortality, which also caused the extreme expansion of a world population. We're still adjusting to that, to the fact that, in the Victorian era, yeah, if you made it past your fifth birthday, you were probably going to live to 70. Unless you were, well, in the working class, in which case you also had to make it past, on the one hand, your first childbirth, on the other hand, the risk of military service, both of which killed a lot of people. But half the infants could be expected to die before their fifth birthday. That's changed. That's dramatic. Now, it has negative aspects as well as positive ones, but it is a dramatic change. It was not done by doctors. It was done by engineers, people who enter, you know, a little bit of research and say, wow, we can filter the fecal matter out of our water supply. What a concept. And then all of a sudden things changed. So that has happened. We also the one other thing that our health system is fairly good at is injury repair. We're fairly good at that. Other than that, we had a brief window of remarkable success caused by antibiotics, but nearly all the antibiotics now are no longer that useful because the bacteria are evolving right around them. with 100 years of the outside, antibiotics are going to be a dead letter because, you know, life finds a way, including that finds a way to kill you. So basically, we did have some remarkable achievements in this civilization. They're not enduring. And it's going to be really interesting to see if enough people remember enough of the details of basic sanitation that, you know, things like clean water and soap, soap is revolutionary stuff. If these two things remain common, then the world's going to slowly have to adjust to having a lot more children survive. But beyond that, in terms of extending life beyond the, you know, the typical, you know, 70, in terms of dealing with these chronic illnesses that are so pervasive, in dealing with all kinds of other problems, we're doing very poorly. And there's the far from minor point that right now medical treatment is the number three cause of death.
Wow.
Yeah.
What's the top two?
It has been this on the one hand you have side effects, often fatal side effects of prescription drugs. You have the fact that nosocomial infections, the fact that hospitals these days are a great place to get infected with pathogens, the fact that there's a lot of surgery and other medical treatment that goes awry, there's a lot of simple malpractice. There are all kinds of nasty things going on within the modern medical industry that kill people. And it is, you know, it's reached the point that, yeah, you know, you've got heart disease, you've got cancer, and then you have medical treatment as the leading causes of death. So, you know, when we're talking about witch doctors, that's maybe the witch doctors may not have been able to do more than provide some useful herbal medicine and make some very effective use of the placebo effect. But at least they weren't feeding people drugs that would kill them. You know, this is actually something that's come up in my own teaching, because one of the things, like many occultists, I ended up learning from my teachers a variety of alternative healing methods, and I'll occasionally deal with people who are going, well, you know, that's not going to treat cancer, or that's not going to do that, and I'm saying, yeah, sure, but it's also not going to give you, you know, these 34 side effects that are caused by statins or what have you.
Well, yeah, and I think. You know, I think back, I often think of trying to remember the guy, not Semmelweis, the other germ theory, you know, famous. At the time, there was a debate between germ theory and territory theory, right? This notion of, you know, which one is really the controller. And on his deathbed, he said, you know, the germ is nothing, the territory is everything. And I think we're very much like a germ-focused, same way that people say we're a coping world and not a, you know, a preparation world, and we don't really pay too much heed to the territory.
And
wait till things go wrong and then try to patch them up instead of thinking
frantically scramble around trying to fix them. Yeah, exactly. You know, it is a classic example of why European culture has gotten itself into so many blind alleys, that you have exactly this kind of debate between the germ theory and the territory theory. Of course, it's both. It's like back early in the history of geology, you had the struggle between the Neptunists and the Plutonists, and the Neptunists insisted that all rocks were laid down as sediment, and the Plutonists insist, no, all rocks are exuded from the earth as lava. Well, they were both part right. But for like a century, these two parties were yelling at each other and making standing square in the path of you know, learning about geology, because neither of them could say, okay, what if it's both?
Why do we struggle for that? You know, I lucked out because my tutor in college, he always used to say, the truth is gray. That was his thing, which I thought was a great quote. But why do we struggle with that grayness?
Ultimately, I think it's a function of the religious origins of Western culture. We have this belief that we've inherited from Christianity that there is one true doctrine, and then there are all of these other false doctrines, and if you get the true doctrine, you go to heaven, and if you believe the false doctrine, then you get the divine boot in the face forever. And that, you know, that was central to the religious modality that around which our society, our civilization came into being. And as religion was replaced by secular ideologies, all the secular ideologies grabbed the same thing. No, this is the one true statement about everything. And so they're all basically trying to be little scientific popes and claim infallibility as they thunder their ex cathedra pronouncements. And this is the thing that Spengler said. You know, the secular ideology of each society is its religion, with all the theological elements quietly covered up.
I mean, this brings me to a further question, because I think it probably would be related. You know, we were talking about cycles earlier, and so this notion of the seasons. It reminded me of a quote by Ouspensky during World War One, where he's walking along, and suddenly, in preparation for World War One, he sees a truck full of, and this is his quote, he says, "crutches for legs yet blown off," which I think is fantastic for the sort of determinism of cycles. But it brings about the question of why do people not get together? Why do people not have the forethought to stop and say, you know what, maybe if we did this, and this, we're not going to have this huge peak and we can have a bit of steady state. Why are we so averse to just slowing down and making sensible decisions?
Well, the thing is, I think the problem is we do make sensible decisions. Yeah. We look at this, in 14th century England, people were saying, okay, we've got through the Black Death. We can now start doing a little more with cities. We've got water power. There's this neat new kind of water wheel. We can actually make things more prosperous. And then in the 18th century, there's steam power. And it makes perfect sense, because there's this for an infinite amount of coal. And basically, at each point, people are facing the situation doing the reasonable thing. They're doing the thoughtful thing. They don't happen to step back to an Olympian view and see, 1,000 years down the line what this is going to result. How can they? And if they did, they'd be sufficiently rare that the other 2,000 people who have the same idea, will just walk right on past them and build the water wheel or the steam engine or what have you. So the cycle is driven by people making reasonable decisions, making the best decisions available to them at the time. That is, I suppose, you could say, the tragedy of history. But at the same time, it's important not to think of, we have this notion in the Western world that death is bad. Mm-hmm. That we shouldn't get old. I forget which Silicon Valley tech bro is prancing around right now, trying to live forever.
Ryan Johnson.
Yeah, getting plasma transfusions from his own son. Yeah. I mean, vampirism by another name.
I think just in terms of if I want something to survive through to 2,000 years, he has these shirts for sale that simply say "Don't die," and I think one of them ends up 2,000. There's something in that I don't know. Strangely poignant.
It's very poignant. And I hope he is buried in one of those.
And so many people would see that as maybe like a cruel statement. I had an interview with Troyer, who wrote a book called Technologies of the Human Corpse, which is about trying to erase the myth that we're scared of death. And his argument was that, what would you rather talk about, your death or how much money you have in your bank account? Which, maybe that works. I don't know if it works. But I still think, I don't think it's a fear. I don't think we have a fear. It's just a complete erasure. I think, I've said this to you before, but as you're saying, there's a certain projection that's come from somewhere where death, night, darkness, skeletons, skulls, these are all bad, And I wonder where this has come from, because this is so unhelpful.
Oh, here I see. This is especially a Western thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, even in some cultures that have a significant Western presence, in Mexico, for example, the Dia de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead, is a celebration. And skulls and skeletons are not spooky. That's just part of life. That's why Santísima Muerte, the most holy death, is a folk goddess with an extremely large and growing following these days. There's you can see the sort of stirring of the old Aztec consciousness, this comfort with death, very common in many societies. We got into it, I think, partly there's that hardcore dualism from Christianity, and then there is the terror of hell. because our, you know, the Christianity, generally the Abrahamic religions in their most recent cycle, obsessed about the idea that if you are not one of the good people, you are going to be tortured forever by God in a bad mood. And that left very deep wounds in our society, that obsession with the thought of death as infinite torment. And I think one of the reasons we have had such a flight into atheism over the last couple of hundred years in the Western world is people who are frantically trying to say, no, I'm not going to fry for all eternity, I'm just going to stop being. But there's still that terror, there's still that, you know, the fear that as soon as you die, the devil is going to sink his claws into you and God is going to laugh in your face. Mm. And so,
but once again, buys into the notion of that sort of tribalist full stop, yeah. Right? Like this side and then it ends. Whereas
I guess
you would see that, you know, death is just a change. In a way, morbid as this will sound to Westerners,
death is just a change. Exactly. We are always in the middle of dying. You know, we are always going through these transformations, and we are, technically speaking, we're not the same person entirely that we were yesterday. And so there's, you know, we sleep and we awake, we go through our own, you know, our own small scale death every single night, but we've made that a source of absolute terror. And there's all that, you know, the darkness and the skeletons and all this radical dualism that pervades our society these days. It's also this obsession with binary divisions where every spectrum has to be divided into two far ends with nothing in between. It's all part of the same cultural phenomenon. And I think it played a large role in our achievements as a civilization, and it is playing a large role in our failures and our ultimate destruction.
Were you ever afraid of death?
When I was a child, I was a little worried about it. I was going, okay, the way I thought about it, when I got a little older, I couldn't come up with a metaphor. If you were to be told that tomorrow somebody is going to come and grab you put you into a bus and drive off, and you have no way of knowing where it's going, would you be scared?
Yeah, probably.
Yes. You know, most people would find that a very unnerving prospect, even if you were going someplace really nice, because you don't know. It's just a total crapshoot. Then, of course, I wasn't raised within Christianity. I mean, I grew up in one of the least religious parts of the United States, the Pacific Northwest. There was like one family in our neighborhood that was religious, and everyone thought they were weird. So the thought, you know, over the course of my teen years, I did a lot of reading and explored a number of things. I read quite a bit about the evidence for things like reincarnation and so on, and gradually came to the conclusion that, okay, it's not that big a deal because I have some idea of what to expect. And then, you know, getting seriously involved in occult philosophy, and also, you know, having some apparent past life memory surface, it was that's very reassuring. I mean, okay, I've been here, done this. Okay, it's not a problem. So, you know, at that point, it stopped being anything to worry about.
What's it going to be like for people who just completely aren't prepared, who actually probably do maybe believe on some level that they're going to be here forever?
Yeah, exactly. No, it's going to be a shock to them, but I think as they go through the process and realize that they still exist, a lot of them are going to go, oh wow, okay. So I didn't need to be that terrified. Of course, depending on what they've done, there are issues of karma and things like that. The process of the process of going through the afterlife, according to occult tradition, involves a certain amount of reliving your life in an objective light where you can see exactly, you know, you don't get to portray it to yourself as you want it to be. You get to see what you actually did. Mm. And that's heaven or that's hell. Mm. But, you know, that's for those people who take occult teaching seriously or who have reason to do so. And I'm not going to try to insist that my entire audience, our entire audience just now, ought to just take that on faith. Faith is the last thing we need here. A certain amount of open-mindedness will do much more.
Which, just out of interest, which occult teachings would that be?
Well, almost anything in classic occultism. Whether you're looking at the Theosophists, the Anthroposophists, some of the Rosicrucian material that I've studied, Druid traditions, and so on, you find reincarnation is the standard teaching in all of them, and all of them draw on the same kind of evidence that was studied by the various psychical science researchers back in the day, and then, of course, who is it? Dr. David Stevenson, who published whole volumes of evidence for reincarnation. If you get into any Western occultism between about 1850 and about 1970, you'll run across very much the same teaching.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm gonna just fly off on a completely different tangent here that is related to our conversation, however, but because it's something people have pestered me about this, I really want to know his thoughts on this. So I think it's probably some version of the savior myth once again. But AI, right? This is why everything's so transparent these days, is that AI is the big thing, right? It's the new thing that's going to save everything. I don't have too much to say about it because, I've played around with the AI that we currently have, and it's really awful and just ruining everything. But generally speaking, what are your thoughts? I mean, what is this phenomena as well? What's the root of this?
I have lived through... I would have to sit down and count how many. Here's the next wonderful thing that will save us all: technology. Mm-hmm. Okay, it never does. Computers were going to do this, mm-hmm. And personal computers, especially. Once we got computers into everyone, that was going to just transform the world and make it all wonderful. Again, look out the window. AI. The assumption that I hear from the AI types is that, the only thing that's keeping us from having the imaginary Tomorrowland utopia of our dreams is that we don't know how to do it. It can't possibly be that it's not an option. It can't possibly be that there are real limits. And, if let's say they did get some kind of super intelligent supercomputer, most of the laws of nature can be phrased fairly clearly as, you can't do that. Mm. Think of the conservation laws and so on. And so our super intelligent supercomputer spends a few weeks understanding the entire universe and says, well, sorry, but you can't have that. Mm. There's no physical way for you to to get the amount of energy and the amount of resources you need when you've already wasted so much. Sorry. I published a story which kind of was along those lines. It's complicated story. Grist magazine did this contest where they wanted woke future stories full of hope and joy and this kind of stuff. They're horrible. I mean, one of their winning ones had humanity being saved by learning how to use different pronouns. It was that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so I actually was involved in a counter contest, which put together another collection of stories, which titled "The Flesh of Your Future Sticks Between My Teeth." We were feeling, those of us who put it together were feeling in a kind of raffish mood. And my entry for this was a story in which super intelligent AI computers figured out the way to save the world was to get all of these managerial class people who use all these resources and talk endlessly about how everyone else has to cut back and off them. Mm. because the notion is, again, it's theology. These people think that AIs are not only gods, but gods that are their pets, where they can just pat them on the head and say, okay, now give us everything we want, and all of a sudden the goodies start pouring out. It has never occurred to them that maybe there are real limits. It has never occurred to them that maybe we've wasted our chance, that maybe even a super intelligent AI could do no more than say, well, actually, Oswald Spengler was right, and guess what? Deal.
Yeah. I think the thing with this as well is that even with all these technologies, I mean, computers are a good example, and then handheld computers and then remote mm-hmm. work and all this, it's much like people who go traveling to find themselves. They don't realize they've taken themselves with them. Mm-hmm. In that, even after all these great technologies, we're still stuck with ourselves, and no one's, mm-hmm. I certainly haven't, but no one's becoming individuated, to go back to what we were talking about earlier. These don't change anything of the quality. And so it's still a bunch of fairly ignorant apes.
Yeah.
Doing stuff.
Exactly. Exactly. Trying to, you know, a bunch of ignorant apes dancing around a wooden pole they've splashed with colored mud, insisting that the juju in the pole is going to give them all kinds of goodies. Except we call the pole splash with mud AI now. And this is something I expect to go on certainly through the end of my life, probably for another century or more before winter really sets in and the entire worldview of industrial society collapses and we end up back in that barbarism of sense. Is this conviction, since, you know, religion did not come up with a savior who would show up on time and save us from the consequences of our own mistakes, that of course, technology, our substitute religion, has to come up with that savior. I mean, you see this in kind of in bold relief with the transhumanists and singularitarian people who literally their entire belief is Protestant fundamentalist Christianity and science fiction drag. For Jesus, replace superintelligent computers. For the second coming, read the singularity. For the glorified bodies are like the robot bodies into which we'll all be uploaded. For, you know, and you just, it's, you know, computer geek fundamentalist Protestantism. And yet, if you tell them that, you will get this blank look. You know, the like cows watching a passing train.
So, I mean, just in relation to our whole conversation about, you know, collapse and cycles, there's a couple of questions I'd like to ask. I mean, the first one being, has anything over your own lifetime surprised you that you might consider, oh, I really wasn't expecting that to happen?
Yes, actually. There have been several of those, and most of them have been great disappointments. At the end of the 1970s, the early 1980s, I did not expect the appropriate technology movement, all these people who seemed to be gearing up to deal with the consequences of our ecological predicament and actually move toward a sustainable society, to crumple, to run like scared rabbits into the arms of Ronald Reagan. And they did. It was one of the most embarrassing things I've ever seen. People who were, you know, loudly talking about how important the Earth is, and they turn on a dime, and all of a sudden they're, you know, be investing in stock and voting and, you know, voting for Ronnie. We had a second version of that again at the end of the peak oil movement, when it became very clear that if you wanted to talk about climate change and only climate change, there was funding to be had. There was publicity. There were all these things. But you had to stop talking about peak oil. And you'd be amazed how many people chickened out and knuckled under. And you know, the whole peak oil movement popped like a balloon. And I have watched an enormous number of people of whom I had fairly high opinions abandon their apparent ideals at the drop of a hat. I mean, to touch on a topic that I think is perhaps even edgier, the number of people who responded to the whole coronavirus business, people who were into alternative health care, people who were into being skeptical of corporations and doubting the health care industry, all of a sudden, no, we must have total faith in what the pharmaceutical industry tells us, and no, we can't use anything alternative. We have to just go line up and get the shot. It was bizarre. And it left me with, you know, those experiences and others like them left me with a far more cynical attitude toward humanity than I wish I had. You know, I wish we were something like our fantasies, but, you know, yeah, apes capering around a pole.
One thing, just, you know, use the word cynical. And it's just something I've been thinking about recently, because I'm fairly pessimistic and cynical myself. Is that, you know, if you trace that back, you're looking really at the father of cynicism, which is Diogenes and his back. And it's interesting because his point with cynicism was to deride the virtues and principles of the society that surrounded him. It was a way of living. To, you know, throw that in everyone's faces. But it makes me wonder if you can even be cynical today, because we don't really have any principles or values that anyone holds sincerely. So how can you actually be cynical today? You know, what could you actually do that would truly rile someone up? I mean, I guess questioning progress, right, is the thing.
Yes. You can question progress. You can question the coronavirus vaccines. Those who did that riled up an enormous number of people. You can question whatever the obsession du jour is. When I started writing about the war in Ukraine, for example, and did not simply do it in the sort of caricatured good guy versus bad guy. I had people ranting in various forums about how I had the wrong opinions about Ukraine, you know. Openly. You can definitely, all you have to do is break with the groupthink and you can get people in a tizzy fit. So cynicism is still an option, you'll be pleased to know. I thought Diogenes, the thing about Diogenes that I was like the best, it's not living in the barrel and this kind of stuff or the business with Alexander the Great, but he would go walking through the agora with a lantern and people would ask him, what are you doing? I'm looking for an honest man.
Yeah. It's great. Yeah, he's a great guy,
and you know, and a great metaphor that, you know, there he has the lantern, implying that, you know, this is socked in darkness, even though it looks like daylight.
It's the original Hermes,
you know. Yeah, exactly. But we've got, but you know, Diogenes would have plenty of employment now, because, you know, it is standard practice for people in our society to insist that, you know, we live in this uniquely enlightened time, in an era where, you know, we're closer to achieving justice and all these ideals and all these abstractions than ever before. And yet our society is in many ways a miserable failure and is failing more rapidly as the day passes. So, you know, Diogenes could walk through the streets today saying, I'm looking for progress. Have you seen any? And has a flashlight, which he's shining around, you know, making sure to point it on the crumbling buildings and the people living rough on the streets and so on, and saying, where's this progress you were talking about?
Are there any aspects of collapse that you rarely get a chance to talk about or to mention?
No, actually, one of the great things about, you know, one of the things, I'm not fond of the internet, but it has certain advantages. And one of the things is that it makes it possible for viewpoints that are way out there on the fringes to find their audience. And this has happened. I mean, you can also do it if you have a thriving magazine culture. During the 1920s, 100 years ago, there were small magazines that did the same thing, and people would find out about them and so on. But the internet works very well for that. My audience is used to just about anything that's having to do with collapse. And in fact, they're constantly saying, well, what about this? And what about that? So I think I've pretty much discussed the whole subject.
All right, then. Well, is there anything you'd like to add about our conversation? I mean, and also, of course, what are you working on? And what books of yours could people put under their tree for Christmas, I guess?
They should need a complete set of all my books to put under the tree, of course, but we'll get to that.
They need a big tree.
They need, that's fine. I'm good with this. One of the things I'd like to say is one of the crucial points about getting out of the burden of abstraction is that we do not need all of these abstract things. We do not need all of these tokens of progress to lead a decent and even a happy life. Plenty of people have done that in eras of decline with perfect grace. It does help if you stop believing that, you know, you stop waiting for the great pumpkin or the great AI or whoever it is to rescue you. But If you pay attention to what's going on, if you focus on the realities of your own life, you can actually lead a perfectly happy life for as long as you spend on this planet, in this incarnation, and even though society is falling to bits around you. Many people do this, and you can do it too. So I don't want anyone to go, oh, there's no hope, and go jump in the Thames or something like that. So that's what I'd like to, you know, my Christmas wish for everyone is that they will look around and say, yeah, things are going to bits, but I can get by. And in terms of what am I working on now? I have a flurry of things coming out over the next year. I've been my tentacle novels, the Weird of Hali and its companion novels, all set in a kind of H.P. Lovecraft world seen through a funhouse mirror. Those are the 7 books of The Weird of Hell Yarn. Now back in print. I've just done page proofs for the reprint of the other 4 Tentacle novels. So that's occupied a lot of my time. Mm-hmm. I also have a new fiction series, a set of occult mysteries, occult detective stories, with 18-year-old Ariel Moravec and her grandfather, Dr. Bernard Moravec, who is a serious occultist, in a non-existent town in some non-existent corner of the eastern United States. And those are fun. One of those is out now, the Witch of Criswell. The next one, The Book of Ha'atan, will be out in the spring and so on. I'm working right now, digging through various books on geomantic divination to look at a new book on advanced geomancy. And I've got some plans in terms of books on the nature of enchantment, which will rile a lot of people, I'm sure. So that's kind of what I'm working on right now.
Well, sounds great. Good. As always, it's been a great conversation.
Thank you. I've had a great time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.